Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana. And there was just something about biting into that exceptional sandwich in a gas station that just made it a great experience.
That's Rick Garrett, who's been called a breaded pork tenderloin connoisseur. Traditional Arts Indiana is here with a tribute to that iconic sandwich. Harvest Public Media has the story of Des Moines training farms. In the second half of our show, we grill some salmon on a cedar plank with Chef Daniel Orr. And then we catch up with some biology students who got their hands dirty collecting samples at a local organic farm. Their findings may surprise you. They sure did surprise the farmer. Stay tuned. Here's the latest food news headlines. Anna Coogan starts us off with a story about reducing food waste.
That's right. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has become known for groundbreaking proposals like the citywide ban on trans fat and a proposed big soda ban. Now he's launched a number of pilot programs for composting across the Big Apple. Although the new initiative is currently small, it is expected to expand to 100,000 New York City homes and apartments this fall. Sanitation officials expect the entire city to participate by 2015 or 2016. New York City creates 1.2 million tons of food waste annually. While the program has been largely successful thus far, some citizens have expressed reservations. City dwellers are resistant to mandatory composting, especially if it comes with fines. Sanitation is also a concern, keeping the discarded food from attracting pests and causing odors. Other residents are feeling recycling fatigue, complaining that separating metal, glass, and plastic in addition to trash is already too much. With Bloomberg leaving office at the end of the year, the future of the program is up for debate. Nearly 23,000 pounds of ground beef have been recalled in a recent E. coli scare. The recall has been traced to the National Beef Packing Company in the town of Liberal, Kansas. The ground beef affected has a sale date of June 14, 2013, and was produced on May 25, 2013. Officials are warning consumers to check their frozen goods to see if any stored beef is affected. So far, no illnesses have been reported in conjunction with this recall. National Beef has set up a website for more information about the voluntary recall. Find that link on our website, eartheats.org. The House is addressing the farm bill this week. It was no surprise that the chamber voted to cut food stamps by $2 billion a year. A Democratic amendment to restore $20.5 billion in food stamp cuts was easily defeated, 234 to 188. Lawmakers are hoping to push the legislation through sooner rather than later. Keep an eye on Earth Eats' Twitter feed for daily updates on the progress of the farm bill. Just search for Earth Eats. And the FDA plans to inspect every cantaloupe operation in the U.S. this season. The new inspections are a response to two bacterial outbreaks, one of which was traced back to salmonella from cantaloupes grown at Chamberlain Farms in Owensville, Indiana. The other was a 2011 listeria outbreak that originated in Colorado and was responsible for two deaths in Kentucky and more than 170 illnesses in 21 states. Purdue Extension is helping growers by hosting a series of preparatory workshops. The programs show growers how to better prepare their packing houses for the upcoming harvest and update them on current FDA inspection activities. Combined attendance so far has reached 40 to 50 farmers, and officials expect another 20 or so to attend Friday's session. Read more about these news articles on our website, eartheats.org.
Anna Coogan, thanks for the news.
You got it.
Midwestern cities have a long history of resettling refugees. Cities typically have the resources to help families adjust, including English classes and public transportation. But the fertile land here calls to those refugees who farmed in their home countries. Across the region, several training farms have developed to help those new Americans grow food and businesses. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, a new one is just taking root in Des Moines.
Not the whole thing.
Even the barn here is a refugee, an historic structure relocated from a high school.
Shuba?
Yeah?
Do you want to go next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Donna Wilterdink splits apart tomato starts and hands them to Chuba Rajabu, who now lives here, some 8,000 miles from his native Burundi. He'll also transplant peppers and cabbage and tuck seeds into the fertile soil of his new homeland. Wilterdink is the farm assistant with Lutheran Services of Iowa, the nonprofit that has been helping refugees find land to cultivate.
There you go. Thank you. You're welcome.
It's an effort the Iowa Department of Agriculture wanted to encourage. Secretary Bill Northey realized he might be able to help. He attends Valley Church in West Des Moines, which owns 35 acres of land it was in the process of developing.
Two things hit me at the same time, thinking this is a space that's just perfect for them to be able to let refugees be able to farm.
The church is just finishing a new community center, and beyond the ball fields are 24 50 by 50 foot plots with the weathered barn on the opposite side. Till now, the refugees grew food for their families in community gardens. Now they can farm. Wilterdink held a crop planning workshop in the spring.
We discussed what they could sell at market, what things would sell well at market, and what people would be interested in purchasing.
The refugees come from Burundi, Rwanda, Bhutan, Nepal, and Burma, now known as Myanmar. Wilterdink says some have saved seeds from their own countries.
The greens that they have seed from their own countries will do fine in Iowa, especially in the spring and the fall when the cooler temperatures come in.
Each grower has paid $100 toward the costs, but most of the expenses are paid by grants for now. Chantal Gatimatare grew various plants back in Africa, including cabbage, peppers, eggplant, and onions that she's planting here. Her daughter, Charlotte, translates for her.
She's hoping to get some money from this whole thing so she can help her family.
Gatimatare works the soil with a hoe. Next to her plot is one worked by a woman from Rwanda, who is across from a Nepali family. Mukiza Gahetano plans to grow many of the same things he grew in Burundi.
I will plant some beans and some corn, but a lot of vegetables. Some I will sell and another part I will use in my farm.
As he and his wife work the land, their two young sons and a friend join the singing. All of these growers must participate in a monthly market at the church to learn sales and other skills. Other training farms in Lincoln, Nebraska and Kansas City have similarly leveraged nonprofit resources to get experienced farmers started in this country. Wilterdink will work with the farmers during the season and throughout the year so they continue to learn business skills. Secretary Northey says refugees may never change the face of industrial agriculture in Iowa, but they can certainly contribute to the local economy.
I would think we may see some businesses grow out of this.
He says just being involved in agriculture will help introduce these refugees to other farmers and opportunities. And training farms can work. Community Crops in Lincoln, Nebraska already has celebrated the launch of multiple businesses from alumni. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. The breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is a dish indispensable to Indiana taste buds. It's generally accepted to have been invented at Nick's Kitchen in Huntington, Indiana, but Iowa has also staked a claim to the title of home of the tenderloin. Betsy Shepard of Traditional Arts Indiana's Second Servings takes a closer look at this Midwestern staple.
Any Hoosier menu that doesn't include the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich has a mammoth hole in it. The breaded pork tenderloin, which often spans the size of the plate on which it's served, is a mainstay in Indiana cuisine. According to Rick Garrett, the breaded pork tenderloin connoisseur who has been featured on the Food Network, Indiana identity is defined, in part, by this celebrated staple.
Like the Indianapolis 500 and all the IU championships are certain things that people relate with Indiana. And I think the breaded tenderloin is one of those.
Why the breaded pork tenderloin? And why Indiana? To understand that, you have to understand its origins.
The story that I have got is that the family that owned the original restaurant was a German family. And there is a German dish called schnitzel, which is basically a breaded veal cutlet. In Indiana, in the 1920s and 30s, veal was not a real common commodity. but pork was. So he thought, I wonder what would happen if I bred this, and a legend was born.
Rick's love for breaded pork has taken him all over the Midwest in search of the perfect sandwich. And according to Rick, the best breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is found in one of the unlikeliest of places.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana. And there was just something about biting into that exceptional sandwich in a gas station that just made it a great experience.
If that description wasn't enticing enough, then for the love of adventure and all things pork, my coworker James and I decided to take a pilgrimage to Knobbone to see for ourselves what people were hailing as Indiana's holy grail of breaded meat. So how did we find the off-the-grid joint Rick was talking about? Roger Sharp, the owner of Nomart, made it easy for us.
That's why on my sign it says, home of the original Knobbone tenderloin, because I am the originator of this tenderloin.
Roger was tight-lipped about some of his specialty ingredients, but ever the gracious host and breaded pork promoter, Roger gave us a tour of Nomart and walked us through the step-by-step process of sandwich making. First, he soaks them in a marinade.
This is what they look like after they've been in my marinade. I take them out and drain them. The drier they are, still want them tacky. The breading sticks to them good, and it doesn't hurt my oil.
Then he hand breads them. And finally, his tenderloins are broasted, not fried.
We're going to put this in here, and I'm not going to tell you how long. We're not going to put them in something and let them soak in oil and get saturated with oil. We're going to put them in here, and instead of cooking from the outside in, we're going to cook them from the inside out.
And now for the moment of truth.
All right, here goes. Time for the taste test. Oh, my goodness.
It's like a better chicken nugget.
You'll have to excuse James. He's a vegetarian. Once you try their breaded pork tenderloin sandwich, it won't be a mystery why people keep going back. Nomart and many of the local diners that specialize in breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches are places where people gather to enjoy the foods that define what it means to be a Hoosier.
Thanks to Betsy Shepherd and everyone at Traditional Arts Indiana for that report. Hear more from their second serving series at traditionalartsindiana.org. Coming up.
So, you know, taking students to a farm to sample fecal material, sample poo, right, is an interesting experience.
Irene Newton is an assistant professor of biology at Indiana University. She led a group of senior biology students as they collected research about bacteria on a local organic farm. Results from one study looking at antibiotic resistance in pigs coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The FDA estimated that 29 million pounds of antibiotics were fed to U.S. livestock in 2009. A couple years later, the FDA restricted the use of certain antibiotics in animal agriculture as a way to address what some experts say could become a catastrophic global health threat. Organic practices prohibit the use of antibiotics in feed for the purpose of stimulating growth in the animals. Then why do some organic animals have antibiotic-resistant bacteria in their systems? This was a question posed by a group of biology students at Indiana University. First order of business for the young researchers, visit the farm to collect samples. Irene Newton has a dozen or so nervous students seated around her living room. The first group is ready to present their final research projects for Newton's class, Environmental Microbiology Laboratory.
Okay, our study is the resistance movement, an examination of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria found in organically farmed or raised pigs.
Newton is an assistant professor of biology at Indiana University. Today, she's running the projector and the timer to keep presentations under 15 minutes. This is a very different scene from how the project started out back in January. The students visited We Farm in Owen County, Indiana, as a group to collect samples for their research. Samples is a nice way to put it.
So, you know, taking students to a farm to sample fecal material, sample poo, right, is an interesting experience. And initially they were quite squeamish about getting in there, but they all went at it, you know, and they were hovering over their samples on the ground, protecting it from other pigs, preventing other students from getting at it, you know, like, this is my, you know, POV, you know, don't touch this. It was really hilarious.
Well, it was, you know, 8 a.m., so we were all pretty tired.
Lauren Christensen is a senior studying microbiology. She hopes to go to vet school to work with large animals.
We checked up. It was snowing that day. There was probably 6 inches of snow on the ground. Freezing cold. Pigs everywhere. We saw a lot of pigs. you know. Anyway, that was funny. And, you know, we have a bunch of, you know, 18 or, you know, mentally 18-year-old men in our class. So that was enjoyable.
They were given access to the farm's pigs, cows, and chickens. Owner-operator of We Farm, Josh Eganolf, is in the back of the room for the presentations, occasionally tossing in a really thoughtful question or comment.
I was working on I bailed on a doctorate in ecology recently and became a full-time farmer, so...
Newton could have taught these same concepts in any number of other settings, but she wanted to give the students a real-life, hands-on experience. Thanks to her existing relationship with Eganolf and his wife, Laura Beth Wayne, the farm was a perfect location. She also says there's no shortage of bacteria on a farm.
I've always been interested in interactions between organisms, especially the idea of the unseen majority having such a dramatic impact on our health and biology.
The groups covered topics ranging from how cellulose breaks down in a cow's gut to the diversity of bacteria found in pigs of varying ages. The group presenting research about antibiotic resistance in organically raised pigs seemed to pique everyone's interest. They took fecal samples from roaming pigs and confined pigs to test if a pig's environment on an organic farm allows access to a more diverse set of antibiotic bacteria.
And not only are antibiotics artificially introduced, but they're also found in the environment and naturally produced, which result in resistant bacteria in organically farmed meat or raised meat.
What Ruby was talking about was we were looking at the resistance that we found in the fecal bacteria, and we know that the farmers do not introduce any antibiotics into it, so we wanted to know how the resistance could have gotten there.
Eganolf does occasionally treat an animal's acute problems with a dose of penicillin, but actually penicillin resistance didn't show up in their results. What did show up was that the roaming pigs have higher resistance to natural antibiotics, while the confined pigs have higher resistance to artificial antibiotics like tetracycline and ampicillin, despite the fact that the pigs aren't ever treated with these drugs.
They had resistance to these antibiotics that we couldn't find anything in the environment that was producing them, but they had a resistance to it. So somewhere in the past, they must have been fed that antibiotic and they developed a resistance to it, or generations past.
Justin Boyd says the literature told them that antibiotic resistance persists over several generations. Eganolf says he did buy the grandparents of these pigs from a conventional farmer.
You know, something to be said for the stock and where you source your pigs from. You know, getting to know the farmers that you buy from rather than just getting an animal at auction. And then once you are pretty confident that you have the right stuff to keep those lines going on your farm.
The other part of this group's research confirmed what Eggenolf says organic farmers have assumed all along, that raising animals in a more natural way on rangeland and not confined exposes them to greater diversity of bacteria.
And it is true that a diversity of microorganisms, a diverse community, makes a more stable community, makes a community more able to accomplish the task that the host would like it to do.
All in all, Newton says she's pleased with the students' presentations. Some of these students will probably go on to work with animals in their careers, and some might prefer to stick to the confines of a laboratory. We were chatting in the Earth Eats offices earlier this week about how we've yet to fire up the grill this season. Well, shame on us for that. Well, Lynn Schwartzberg was here a couple weeks ago talking about barbecue, but that only sort of counts. After all the pork in the first half of our show, let's mix it up with some salmon grilled on a cedar plank.
It's a good, kind of a unique way of preparing salmon that you can do all year round. I mean, it's fun, you know, to slip on your clogs and run out to the barbecue in the snow and throw some of these on in the middle of the winter, but it's just as fun to be there in your Speedo cooking during the summer.
Whoa, family show!
And what we've done is we've got a cedar plank here. You can smell that. Smells kind of like a sauna.
Yeah, it does.
You know, and we're going to give the salmon a sauna of a lifetime. Just giving, I've got some of Tim Burton's maple syrup from Burton's Maple Camp.
1 gallon jug of the stuff.
And this stuff is good.
Great.
Okay, we're going to put a little bit of red onion. Okay, I've got a little bit of Meyer lemon. My cousin Heather down in Florida grows, actually she steals Meyer lemons from her neighbor and sends them up to me.
She grows, I mean steals.
And then you can take this whatever direction you want. You know, Chef Dan loves his lemon zest. Loves his little crushed red pepper flakes. Okay, we're going to just kind of turn the salmon over in the mixture. And what the maple syrup's going to do is it's going to kind of intensify the smokiness of the cedar plank we're using, as well as caramelize. So get a nice kind of caramelization. All right, so what I'm going to do is I've got this smoking plank. I'm going to put a couple of the slices of Meyer lemon down. Then we put the salmon right on top. Any of those leftover onions. Okay, and we're going to put that back up under the broiler. And we're going to let that cook through. I like my salmon still, you know, medium rare on the inside, so kind of translucent pink. Some people like it well done. What I would suggest is you just keep a good eye on it. You can always stick a little knife in the thickest part of the salmon and open it up and make sure it's to your liking. And if you're getting too much smoke, you can always toss it in the oven and finish it off in the oven. We're going to let that cook for, I would say, 5 to 7 minutes, depending on the heat.
Now,
if you are doing it on a grill, close the grill down, and then that smoke's going to stay and kind of enrobe the salmon as it's sitting in there. And if it starts to overcook or burn, just move it. You can turn off half your grill and move it to the cold side of the grill and let it finish cooking on that side.
Talk to me about the different types of salmon you can get in the grocery store.
Well, you know, the best salmon would be the wild-caught salmon, and that's seasonal and comes from different river mouths where the salmon come in to spawn, and you can go fight the local grizzly bears for the salmon. But those are delicious. You can get, you know, coho, you can get king, you can get White River salmon, which is delicious. And then there are different farm-raised salmons, which means that they're fed food pellets. They're kept in the ocean in large netted areas, and you want to find some that are fed organic food if you can find that. Those will be a little bit more expensive, but not as expensive as the wild. And then finally you have the normal big box salmon on a styrofoam tray, and that's, you know, it doesn't have as much omega-3s in it. It's not as good for you, but you know, the price is there. So you know, it depends whether you're a college student or a 10-year college professor with 3 books, and you can choose whichever you want.
Dousing the fire.
I think the plank has seen its last salmon fillet. All right, we're going to give this a taste.
This will be the fattier part.
Toward the end?
Towards the end, that's the belly part. And then this will be the meatier part. And so if you take a little bit of that, try that, it will taste different from the other side.
Sure.
Taste a little of that maple.
That maple syrup is so nice. It's not sweet. It's not in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And that squeeze of fresh lemon after you pull it out of the broiler or off the grill. And then this is great to serve with something like this, either escarole or an endive, curly endive, because this has a touch of bitterness. The maple syrup and the salmon has a touch of sweetness, so it really has a nice balance. You want to play off those five flavors. Your sweet, your bitter, your salty, your spicy, your umami, all those different flavors are at work here.
We have time for one more quick recipe that you could serve alongside the salmon. Spinach right now all over the farmer's market, so pick some up and make this Asian-inspired salad.
We've got some soy sauce, a couple teaspoons of fish sauce, about a teaspoon of toasted sesame oil, and you can get those really in any big supermarket, but definitely at any ethnic market. They're kind of your secret arsenal. Add them to any of your dishes, and all of a sudden they start to taste a little more exotic. Basically, fish sauce is anchovies, fresh anchovies that are dried, and then they're covered with water and in barrels, and then left in the sun for about a year.
Doesn't that sound tasty, folks?
And it does smell strong, but it tastes great. And if you like Thai food, Vietnamese food, there's usually a little bit of fish sauce in those dressings. The sesame oil is made with white sesame seeds that are toasted and then pressed, so you get a toasted sesame flavor. So that's how that's made. About 2 tablespoons of sesame seeds. We're going to add some scallions. I'd say about three or four scallions. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add some ginger. Probably add about a teaspoon and a half. I'm cutting the ginger across the grain.
And you're not taking time to peel it?
No, when the ginger is young and the skin is smooth, you don't really need to peel it. Now, this is a dish you don't want to add like a citrus or lemon juice to it because it's going to discolor your spinach. You could always add a little bit at the end if you wanted to, but I don't think it's really necessary. Okay, we're going to toss our spinach in this.
That's what you're looking for?
Yeah, delicious.
These two recipes and so many more on our website, along with interviews, news stories, and previous podcasts if you'd like to catch up on what we've been doing the past several years here at Earth Eats. We're on the web at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Ayabon Binder, Justin Boyd, Lauren Christensen, Anna Coogan, Josh Aganolf, Liz Leslie, Irene Newton, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd of Traditional Arts Indiana, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, Therapeutic Massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years. Building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900. Or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We do appreciate you tuning in this week. Happy eating, folks. I'm Annie Corrigan.